It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British voters head to the polls Thursday for what has been described as the most important vote of their lifetimes, whether the United Kingdom should remain in or leave the European Union. Wednesday was the last day of campaigning. Prime Minister David Cameron urged voters to cast ballots to stay in the EU.
We are stronger, we are better off, we are safer in a reformed European Union, and that is why we should vote Remain tomorrow morning in the largest possible numbers.
Conservative politician and Justice Secretary Michael Gove is among the leading advocates for leaving the European bloc.
I respect people on both sides of the argument, and I think it's good that we hear from the heart from politicians and others who want us to remain and who want us to leave. But ultimately, people will have a chance tomorrow to take back control of our democracy, and I think that is a very, very powerful argument.
Two polls ahead of Thursday's referendum showed a slight advantage to the Leave campaign, although there are still many undecided voters. Election analysts say turnout will be crucial. Gunmen in southern Nigeria kidnapped at least 7 people, including 4 Australians and a New Zealander identified as contractors for a mining and engineering company on the outskirts of the city Calabar in Cross River State Wednesday. Their driver was killed. Malcolm Turnbull is Australia's Prime Minister.
The Australian High Commissioner is on the scene, and we are working with the authorities, the local authorities at the highest levels.
Mr. Turnbull said the identity of the kidnappers is still unknown. He described the incident as a very serious criminal assault. The kidnappers have not yet contacted police. Abductions for ransom has been a long-standing problem in the region where much of Nigeria's oil wealth is located. This is VOA News. In Iraq, government coalition forces pressed their 5-week assault on retaking the Islamic State-held city of Fallujah. The French press agency said IS defenders have been pushed back to their last redouts. Brigadier Haider al-Obeidi said almost 90% of the city has now been liberated. He says he hopes the advance will be completed within days. More than 80,000 civilians have fled the fighting, with over 60,000 said to be in overwhelmed displacement camps lacking basic supplies. The U.S. will host a pledging conference next month to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to help Iraqis return to a normal life. Colombia and leftist FARC rebels agreed to a ceasefire Wednesday, with a signing ceremony scheduled Thursday in Havana to end hostilities in a 50-year guerrilla war that killed 220,000 people. Peter Hockham is a Latin American scholar with the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington.
Not only has it been the longest war, it's probably cost the most lives of any war on the mainland of Latin America. And, you know, it's caused Colombia to be among the countries in the entire world which have the largest displaced population.
President Juan Manuel Santos and rebel leader Rodrigo Londono will sign the ceasefire. Peace talks were held in Havana for 4 years. Mr. Santos says he expects final negotiations to be complete next month. The deal, including land reform, will then be put to the people for a referendum. Senior U.S. diplomat Thomas Shannon met Wednesday in Caracas with Venezuela's embattled president, Nicolas Maduro, on ways to improve relations. The countries have not exchanged ambassadors in 6 years amid sharp disagreement over the country's socialist policies. Mr. Maduro, a sharp critic of the U.S., called on Shannon to tell President Obama to rectify his policy toward the country. Shannon pressed for the release of political prisoners. He also met members of the opposition who are trying to form a recall vote, removing Mr. Maduro from office amid the country's deepening economic crisis. Zambia's largest privately owned newspaper has been shut down by the government over unpaid taxes. The owner insists the paper, a frequent critic of the government, is being shuttered in a political move ahead of August elections. Most pre-election street protests in townships around South Africa's capital Wednesday left at least 2 dead, dozens arrested. Shops were looted, vehicles torched. The violence is believed to be tied to the selection of the ruling African National Congress Party's candidate for mayor, Pretoria. The International Monetary Fund has trimmed its forecast for U.S. economic growth this year, predicting 2.2% growth. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde says falling productivity, declining labor force participation, poverty and income inequality are the main factors. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Bati. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A decision by the Zambia Revenue Authority, ZRA, to close down a leading independent newspaper, The Post, has been called an attempt to muzzle free press in the country.
I got a call personally from the Deputy Minister of Finance who told me that our writing, our articles were quite vicious and they were damaging to the ruling party. And he asked me if we could tone down.
That is Joseph Mwenda, the Deputy Managing Editor at The Post, an independent newspaper in Zambia. Arrests continue in Burundi after students defaced textbook photos of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Over 500 students in several provinces have been accused and others arrested. And the government of Ethiopia is denying accusations by its neighbor Eritrea that it is planning a military attack on its territory.
No, we're not making any preparation, and we don't have to make any preparation if we have to attack Eritrea. Because last week we have made a proportional response to the provocations of the regime in Asmara, and our troops have withdrawn.
That is Ethiopian Communication Minister Getachew Reda. And the Somali National Army says it killed 8 Al-Shabaab militants and recovered weapons and ammunition during an operation in central Somalia. Those stories, plus Mark Ouma Sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A decision by the Zambia Revenue Authority to close down the Post newspaper, an independent paper, is aimed at muzzling free press deemed critical of incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his ruling Patriotic Front Party in the run-up to the August 11th general election. This is according to Joseph Mwenda, Deputy Managing Editor and News Editor at The Post. The Zambia Revenue Authority shut down operations of the newspaper's printing plant in the capital, Lusaka, late Tuesday night and also closed down its offices. This followed a dispute between the paper and the Revenue Authority over allegations it owed back taxes. Joseph Mwenda is the Deputy Managing Editor and News Editor at The Post. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the shutdown has politics written all over it. He says the move was to ensure the newspaper is not published or in circulation between the August 11th presidential, legislative and local elections.
We got some information that they wanted to shut us down because of the independent position that we had taken at the newspaper, all right? I got a call personally. I got a call from the Deputy Minister of Finance. This is Honorable Christopher Mbunga, who told me that, you know, our writing, our articles were quite vicious and they were damaging to the ruling party. And he asked if we could tone down and say that this issue that you have with the ZRA can be taken care of. That's one proof we have that it's really intimidation of the media. They're not after tax. They're after our operations. But we stood our ground. We did not pledge to go by the suggestion that was coming from the government. We continue to report as we have always done in the past.
Are you therefore saying that the Zambia Revenue Authority committed an illegality by usurping the powers of the court by enforcing an injunction that is not there by closing down or shutting down your printing press?
It is an illegality, yes. But not only is it an illegality, it's also politics. We are not surprised ourselves because we have evidence that the instructions that are coming from State House are being, you know, implemented by the Zambia Revenue Authority. We can prove that with all the confidence. We have paid most of the money they are claiming, but they just don't want to oblige that. And we have actually showed them that, you know, the court order that is restraining them, but they don't want to follow that. What they've done today is to come to the head office where employees gathered outside because the premises was locked. The employees gathered outside and they fired tear gas at the workers. Chased everybody away. And they were threatening to, you know, to arrest us for unlawful assembly. We shouldn't be in operation as we go to the election.
So you said you have evidence. The Post newspaper has evidence of attempt to muzzle the press. In this case, the Zambia Post newspaper. What are you going to do with that evidence?
We've gone to court with it. As we speak to you, our lawyers, they've just come out of court. And we are hoping that by tomorrow, the High Court can hear our case because we feel that
this is a clear case of trying to muzzle the press. And they've done it very clearly without any, you know, doubt. We also know the reason why they're doing this, by the way. We also know the reason why they're doing this. This newspaper, you know, has brought out a lot of irregularities in the manner the ruling party is conducting their campaigns, the number of people that they've got on board, foreigners, to come and register to vote in the election. We have produced that evidence as a newspaper that the ruling party has registered hundreds of thousands of foreigners to come and register so that the election can be rigged. On top of that, there are companies that have come from outside this country to come and help the ruling party rig the election. We've brought all those accusations out. They have failed to challenge them because our evidence is overwhelming. So we are a hindrance to to the victory that they are anticipating. That is what this is about. They don't want this newspaper to be around on August 11 when we go to elections.
You think this is a backlash following the exposés that the newspaper brought to the fore about what you said has been plots by the ruling party to rig the vote?
Yes, that's correct. And we have evidence. We've produced the evidence. We've told them, look, we have the letters that the president has written to the intelligence division, to his intelligence division, to say, you work with this company called Timo Consulting so that you can help the ruling party secure a victory in the election this year. We have that. We have published that information. All right? In fact, two of our reporters are in court, you know, including Fred Mende himself. And the case they have charged him with is classified, publishing classified information.
Joseph Mwenda is the deputy managing editor and news editor at The Post, an independent newspaper in Zambia. Human rights organizations and various international media watchdogs have condemned the shutdown of The Post. Stephen Ellis, the director of advocacy and communications at the International Press Institute, said that, quote, the misuse of state authority to silence the only major media outlet giving opposition parties a platform can only be seen as an effort to deny voters the information they need to make an informed decision about their future. In the past couple of days, Ethiopia and Eritrea have been accusing each other of starting a border fight. The escalating war of words between the two countries has been of concern to both regional and international observers. Yesterday, a senior advisor to Eritrea's president told a UN hearing that Ethiopia is contemplating full-scale war against Eritrea.
As we speak, Ethiopia is making preparations for a bigger military offensive and is contemplating a full-scale war.
That was Yemane Gebreyab, senior advisor to Eritrea's president. Our colleague Henok Semagzai Fente spoke with Ethiopian Communications Minister Getacha Wereda, who told him there is no preparation for an attack against Eritrea.
No, we're not making any preparation, and we don't have to make any preparation if we have to attack Eritrea. Because last week we have made a proportional response to the provocations of the regime in Asmara, and our troops have withdrawn back to their positions because there is no need for us to escalate the tension.
Now, we have a senior advisor to Eritrea's President Isaias Afwerki telling the UN that it is no coincidence that the UN report came at the same time border conflicts are simmering between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Let's hear what he had to say.
It's no coincidence that the same week that the Commission released its report saw the worst outbreak of hostilities over the border since the end of the war 16 years ago.
Obviously, Yemane and his government at their wit's end are resorting to conspiracy theories to explain why they find themselves between a rock and a hard place at this point. What they are facing in Geneva is absolutely their own fault. And of course, Ethiopia doesn't have to blame for what these people have done to their people. What the UN Human Rights Council and the Commission of Inquiry are telling the rest of the world is that this government, which has been busy destabilizing the region, has also been equally, if not more frequently, busy mistreating its own people, killing its own people, disappearing its own people, and causing all kinds of problems to its own people. So they better respond to that accusation, to that allegation, which we believe is solidly supported by evidence.
Now let's hear from the chairperson.
That I don't think is going to help.
Now let's hear from the chairperson of the UN Inquiry Commission, Mike Smith, and he in detail explained the findings of the commission.
The commission has concluded that Eritrean officials have committed crimes against humanity. The crimes of enslavement, imprisonment, enforced disappearance, torture, persecution, rape, murder, and other inhumane acts have been committed as part of a widespread and systematic campaign against the civilian population since 1991.
Now, the advisor to Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki, Yamane Gebreab, made a statement reacting to the inquiry's findings. And basically what he's saying is this is a pretext to an ICC indictment of the Eritrean regime. Let's hear it and I'll take your reaction.
Stepping way over its mandate, the Commission has made the incredible judgment that the human rights situation in Eritrea constitutes a threat to international peace and security as a pretext to send yet another African country to the International Criminal Court.
Now, as a home for the African Union has been opposed to numerous African leaders being sent to the ICC. What's Ethiopian position on this?
Well, African Union has been partly opposed to ICC targeting African leaders, but it has never supported impunity. It has always called for accountability of leaders for the crimes they commit against their own people. So our position is that any country should be accountable for what it has done to its people.
Now, Eritrea is saying that there is a double standard in this, saying that we're not perfect and we're going through a complete overhaul of the justice system. But there seems to be a double standard. This is what Yamane Gebreab said. And this is something that's also supported by a number of human rights groups that accuse Ethiopia of human rights violations.
You think Eritreans will all of a sudden assume responsibility for their actions if, for example, by some stroke of magic, the so-called Commission of Inquiry also extends its mandate to Ethiopia? And that's preposterous. Let them respond to the accusations that are leveled against them.
Ethiopian Communications Minister Getachew Reda. Arrests continue in Burundi after students defaced textbook photos of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Over 500 students in several provinces have been accused and five have been arrested. Human Rights Watch reports that earlier this month, Burundian intelligence agents arrested 8 secondary school students in Muramvya province and accused them of insulting the head of state. Subsequent to the arrests, their classmates demonstrated in the streets. Security forces shot and injured 2 students and a motorcycle driver who later died. The students who are facing charges of insulting the head of state face up to 5 years in prison if found guilty. From Burundi's capital Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana has this report.
The desecration of the president's photos has angered authorities. Some students scribbled over the photos. Others wrote phrases like, get out or not to the third term. The defacing of the photos started in Moravia province and spread to other areas of the country. 11 students in Moravia have been accused and so far 5 have been arrested. They are charged with insulting the head of state. According to Human Rights Watch, some students demonstrated in the streets against the government's handling of the case. 2 were shot and injured by the security forces. Agnes Bagirichenge is the Secretary General of the Supreme Court.
Suite à l'infraction d'outrage envers le chef de l'État commis par certains élèves de 3 établissements secondaires en commune de Moravia.
Agnes says, following the defacing of the president's picture, which was done by some students in the secondary school in Moravia, that their cases have been opened by the court. She says, the first case includes 6 underage students who went against the law, and the judge provisionally released them, and other 5 will have to face justice. At least 6 out of the 18 provinces have reported the defacing of the textbook photos. Parents are concerned about the ongoing arrests and suspension of students. I talked to one parent in Bujumbura. She says, if something is already done like the way they defaced the president, it was supposed to be handled at the school level. But everything was politicized. They were given a very heavy punishment, and that doesn't exist anywhere else. She says the government didn't confront the problem the right way. As a mother, she says that she is very disappointed that some of those students will miss their third term exams. One of the defense lawyers spoke to me on the phone from Ramve province, where the first incident happened.
Ces enfants n'ont pas réellement, sont pas eux les auteurs de ces
The lawyer says the children who were arrested are not responsible for defacing the pictures on the textbook, that the textbooks are shared in the different classes, even between different schools, so they were only targeted, and they are not necessarily responsible for the allegations. Last week in Ruyigi province, eastern Burundi, school administrators expelled 230 students when they refused to reveal who scribbled on the president's face in the textbooks. UNICEF's regional director for the Eastern and Southern Africa has expressed concern about the arrests and expulsions from school and injuries of children in Burundi. UNICEF says all children in Burundi have the right to pursue their education and attend the upcoming exams in a neutral, safe, and protective environment. Moses Avyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The Nigerian government is eager to find a resolution to months of attacks on its vital oil infrastructure in the Niger Delta. But a ceasefire announced by officials on Tuesday appears to be on shaky ground. Christine reports from Lagos.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity, confirmed the ceasefire deal, but offered no further details. The Niger Delta Avengers militant group said on Twitter no ceasefire had been agreed to. Months of attacks by the Avengers on petroleum infrastructure in the Delta have dropped Nigeria's oil production by as much as half from its usual level of around 2 million barrels per day. Oil is Nigeria's top export. Economists have cited the drop in production as one reason the country's economy, which is Africa's largest, will soon enter a recession. Earlier this month, the government announced it was suspending military operations in the Delta to pave the way for talks. The vice president for Africa operations at intelligence firm Stratfor, Mark Schroeder, says the ceasefire may be a delaying tactic by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It could be to buy time while President Buhari has to essentially negotiate or calculate among his other political constituencies, you know, whether he can afford to increase revenue sharing with the Niger Delta region.
The Southern Delta region is home to almost all of Nigeria's oil production, but remains deeply impoverished. Militancy is nothing new there. A similar insurgency raged until 2009, when the government started paying off fighters and giving them job training in exchange for their halting attacks. The Avengers, a mysterious group that communicates primarily through a Twitter account, could not be reached for comment. In a statement last week, the Avengers demanded the federal government commit to independently mediated talks. The confusion over the truce's existence may be a sign of factionalism within the Avengers, Schroeder said, or it may just be impatience with the Buhari administration. Much of what the group is demanding are resolutions to long-standing grievances in the Delta.
What they want to see above all is some reasonable offer of engagement by the Buhari government.
The Avengers' most recent attack was June 16th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli have reportedly made gains inside the Islamic State-held coastal city of Sirte, while forces loyal to the rival government in Tobruk say they have pushed back al-Qaeda militants in Benghazi. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Militiamen loyal to the unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides. Ahmed Hadia, a spokesman for pro-government military forces in Sirte, told Libyan TV that battles took place in several areas.
قوات البنيان المرصوص حققت تقدما على جميع المحاور في الزعفران والغربيات.
He says pro-government militiamen had pushed IS fighters out of the Zafran and Garbiat districts and quartered them in small pockets of the 700 district and the Ouagadougou conference center. Islamic State fighters were reported to be fighting fiercely despite recent losses, using car bombs, suicide attackers, and other booby-trapped objects. A government military commander in Sirte told journalists that IS fighters had booby-trapped vehicles and shops to stop the government advance into the city. The Libya Herald newspaper reported that 170 pro-government militiamen have been killed and over 700 injured since the start of the military operation dubbed Bunyan al-Marsous to retake Sirte. The paper added that many of the casualties in the fighting were taken to Misrata Central Hospital, where doctors refused to allow journalists to take photos. It indicated that many of the wounded had suffered horrific injuries and that conditions at the hospital were poor because of shortages of drugs, antibiotics, and even nurses. Arab media also reported heavy fighting inside Libya's second-largest city of Benghazi as forces loyal to the government in Tobruk fought to expel Islamic militants loyal to al-Qaeda. Heavy clashes against militants took place in the nearby port of Ajdabiya several days ago. Forces loyal to General Haftar have also carried out airstrikes against Islamic militant positions near Ajdabiya and the eastern militant stronghold of Darna in recent days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Etegwini, South Africa. South African Stephen Mokoka ended East African dominance in 10,000 meters when he prevailed in a scintillating sprint for the finish line, clocking 28 minutes and 2.97 seconds. He shares his experience.
The race was very exciting. I see like the last 2 kilometers, that's when the pace picked up. So when it picked up, I just kept praying that I survived. So when the Ethiopian guy went on the 800 meters to go, all I kept wishing was he must move harder. Because the more he moved harder, the more it hurts, and the more it hurts, the more people die. So I was hoping that he could move harder, but I saw him reducing the pace. And when the Sotho guy went in front, I just told myself that I'm going with him. So I was very happy that at the end of the day, I eventually won.
Going forward, what are your thoughts?
Yes, I'm running the Olympics. So if I can be able to get inside top 10, I'll be very happy.
That was Stephen Mokoka, the Africa 10,000-meter champion. Meanwhile, on the infield, South African Jaco Engelbrecht surprised himself emerging victor in men's shot put with a heave of 20 meters. He elaborates.
Yeah, it was tough. This was actually a very tough ride up in the build-up to get to the event because I got a stomach injury about 2 weeks, two and a half weeks ago. So I was actually thinking of actually withdrawing from the event. So last week, started training again, and this helped me to qualify get in for the World Champs for next year.
That was South Africa's Jaco Engelbrecht, the Africa men's shot put champion. Still on the infield, Senegal's Ami Sene is delighted with her triumph in the women's hammer throw in a championship record of 68.35 meters. She explains why.
I'm very happy because I lost my title, and today I win.
That was Senegal's Ami Sene, the Africa women's hammer throw champion. Back on the track, Pumilile Nzinisa improved her Swaziland women's 100-meter record with a winning time of 11.11 seconds in her heat. Her old mark was 11.36 in France in May. What's more, Nzinisa is well within the Rio de Janeiro Olympic qualifier of 11.32 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Oumeyer in Etegwini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, June 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryock and Peter Clody, as well as sports editor Mark Owuma, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, my JoJo. This one, my JoJo.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews right here on VOA Africa.